Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. I have SMA Type 2, and I am a columnist and forums director for SMANewsToday.com. Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. And today we have another installment in our series on mental health and disability. And today we are focusing on LGBTQ activists in the SMA community. So we have with us two panelists, and also we have one who has submitted questions electronically, and I will read her responses. But we have with us Hugo Trevino, who has been on the podcast before and on our 31 Days of SMA many times. He currently works in academia and is a disability and LGBT activist. Hugo, thanks so much for coming back.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. As Kevin kind of mentioned, my name is Hugo Trevino, and I do identify as a gay male. My pronouns are he, him, and I'm super excited to kind of share about some of my thoughts about mental health and being part of the LGBT plus community.
Thank you so much, Hugo. And we also have with us Ali Ramos, who was also on the podcast earlier this year. She is a mental health professional and as also activist in the LGBTQ and disability communities. So, Ali, glad to have you back as well.
Thank you for having me, Kevin. I am a pansexual woman. My pronouns are she, her, and I love talking about this community and how important and special they are, as I am too. So, yeah.
Absolutely. So glad to have you. And then, as I mentioned to our third panelist today, Sherry Toe, who is one of our columnists. She uses she, they pronouns, and she can't do, well, part of it is she lives in Singapore, so it's very hard to coordinate times where we're both available. But she, although she can't really do video interviews, but she did submit answers to questions I sent her electronically. So I'll be reading those during today's discussion. We were going to have Dominic Evans on this podcast, but he had a last minute emergency. I might, if the timing works out, interview him separately and add it to this later, but just wanted to put that out there as well. I'm really glad to have you both on here today. Okay, so Hugo, let's start with you. So can you, I know you've told your story before, but for those who are listening maybe the first time, can you tell a little bit about your background and how you came to terms with different aspects of your identity, both your sexuality, your disability, anything you want to say about that?
Yeah, I think identity is something that it doesn't happen overnight, right? And it's something that, you know, it's shaped not only by like how we feel, but also like family upbringing, community upbringing, things like that, right? Social values, right, as well, right? And so growing up, I think one of the first identities I obviously identified with was with my nationality or ethnicity, right? And my brown skin. I'm Latino and first generation. I live in a predominantly Latino also community. So there were a lot of Mexicans, a lot of other Latinos in my neighborhood. So that was the first probably part of my identity that I found pride with, and just kind of like being a Latino and going to school and things like that. The other identity that was also very blaring, and the main reason why we're all here is because of my spinal muscular atrophy, right? I have type 3, so I was ambulatory as a child and I was able to walk. I did not stop walking until I was 12 years old, and that's when I started. I got my first manual wheelchair at the age of 9, and then I got my first permanent wheelchair or electric and power wheelchair at the age of 12. But that was also another disability that, like, you know, people would come up to my parents and ask them like, oh, what's wrong with him, right? Like being really rude. And that's not the way you should ask someone. Or, you know, doctors, right? Kind of going to constant doctor's appointments and then kind of like poking, prodding me, hitting my knees, not having reflexes. And so that was like the other blaring identity that I kind of quickly, you know, even as a child, it makes you mature a little bit quickly, makes you realize that, hey, you're different, right? And that you do have this disability. I was also forced to go to like a school that wasn't in my district because of my disability and needing to go to a school that was more accessible. So having to accept my disability identity was also something that was hard because, you know, society, it definitely still works under the medical model that tells you that there's something wrong with you and that you need to be fixed. And so it took a lot of me being like, you know what, I'm depressed because I'm not accepting my disability. It's not going anywhere. I need to stop wishing and dreaming for a cure. And so once I realized that, you know what, my disability is something that makes me who I am, you know, it's something that, you know, is a major part of my identity. When I walk into the room, that's what people kind of first see as well, besides my ethnicity. And so once I accepted my disability, I think that really opened up the gate for me to be able to accept other parts of me. And so the last identity that I was kind of could almost keep like hidden or not have to think about a lot was my sexual identity as well, right? When you're in a wheelchair, people also desexualize you, or like, you know, almost like infantile you, right? My aunts and uncles would always be asking my cousins or whatever, like if they had a little, or like a boyfriend or a girlfriend or blah, blah, blah. But they would always skip that question when it came to me. So I never really had to worry about that or, you know, or think about it too much. And also, you know, just like kids was kind of helping me and things like that. I also didn't really think about it all too much, even though I feel like I always kind of knew that I was gay. And it wasn't until I was a college student that I was finally living on my own. I was hiring personal assistants to help me live independently, that I was finally like, you know, battling with that thing of, do I want to start dating? Do I identify as a gay person? Like, you know, what is that going to look like, especially for my care coming from like, you know, a Catholic family? You know, we're not practicing, but we still have those values, right? So that was another thing too, that I was like, is my family going to accept me? If I come out, like, do I have also the support of my PAs? Are they still going to help me, right? And so as I came out, I kind of invited my PAs, and my story is a little bit different in the fact that I actually told my personal assistants first about me being gay, because I wanted to make sure that they would still be there to care for me and to help me in the event that when I came out to my family, if they weren't supportive, if they were like, we're not helping you anymore or whatnot, that I would still have that support system. Fortunately for me, I had a really positive coming out experience where my family, you know, did support me. They were there for me. They were understanding. And so I didn't have to feel like that kind of like all that stress, right, and fear of like being rejected by my own family. Thankfully, that's not part of my story. But it was just interesting. And also them being like, oh, like you should have told us first, right? Like, you know, and then kind of me explaining why I didn't tell them first and why I told not complete strangers, but, you know, technically not family, right? But other people that I was close to or other caregivers. And so that's kind of like my story of me identifying with my different identities and with my gay identity.
Thank you, Hugo. And Allie, same question to you. So can you talk a little about your background and like Hugo, exploring those different aspects of your identity?
Yeah, definitely. And as Hugo stated, we, you know, being a disabled person, sometimes that's more of the focus whenever you're younger and just kind of trying to figure out how to survive and thrive with having a disability. So I also, you know, I grew up in a very, very conservative Baptist household in the panhandle of Texas. And that oftentimes means that going to church every week, you know, I think the first time I went to church, I was like 2 weeks old, right? And so growing up in that environment, hearing about how wrong it is to be in the queer community or how you're going to burn in hell for all of these things, you know, and it's like, well, I don't want to do that. I would rather just kind of suppress these feelings. And looking back on pictures, like at pictures of me as a teenager, I just see this like, this kid who's just struggling through social aspects, through like kind of being a wallflower, through being ignored with like dating, like seeing other people like going to, you know, dating people and like having all of these experiences. And then I'm like, huh, okay, well, I guess I'm not desirable, you know, and so dating as, you know, it was already an uncomfortable experience. So I, again, suppressed the queer identity that I have. And I was scared too. I was like, if I come out, my parents aren't going to talk to me. Like, they're not going to support me. Even when I was like long supporting myself, you know, like I have my own house, I was married, I was self-sufficient, I had PCAs, and they're all gay. So it was like, I didn't have to come out to them, you know, because I was like, I've already had this community, and it wasn't really that surprising for everyone except my parents, you know, and kind of like, coming out to them was a difficult thing for me. I wrote a letter. I dropped it off on their doorstep. And I said, hey, there's a letter out there for you. And it scared me, you know? I thought, what if this is like the last time I talked to them? What if, you know, what if they don't accept me? And of course, my story, like, thank goodness they are supportive. They're learning, you know, they're still learning, and there's a big learning curve. And I know some things they aren't completely comfortable with, and that's still a learning curve. And I told my husband, and at that point, I was like, I want a divorce. Because I'm not comfortable in this marriage. And so it was a very supportive environment, although very difficult. I also found my beautiful, wonderful, handsome trans boyfriend, and he is just the most amazing thing that's happened right now. And so kind of exploring that identity and accepting it has opened up my life in a huge way.
That's awesome. And Allie, thank you so much for sharing that. And lastly, I mentioned, you know, Sherry is our third guest on here. She's one of our columnists for SMA News Today. And so I asked her this question. I said, in your column, you've written about the intersection of your sexual orientation and SMA. How has writing about SMA helped you explore other aspects of your identity and mental health? And Sherry responded, living with SMA is weird in that it can both bar you from exploring in a traditional manner, like going to parties and outings or on dates with schoolmates, and it can also free you from the expectations of gender and sexuality and lead you to question social norms of all sorts. It's a paradox, sometimes a very loud paradox that can be difficult to make sense of. Writing helped me to tune the noise out and figure out what SMA means for me and different facets of my identity. For example, it was through writing my column that I realized I might identify as genderqueer instead of cis. And so I wanna thank you all for your responses to this. This is really great. And so next I wanna talk about the ways your work kind of coincides with mental health. And so Hugo, I know you've worked in different fields before, and you're in academia currently, and I know a little bit about what you do. So can you talk about that role and how it allows you to be a mental health advocate and connect with your students?
Yeah, so I've also been very fortunate. I'm from the Chicagoland area. And so, you know, big cities tend to also be a little bit more liberal, you know, when it comes to this. But, you know, there's still that fear, right, of like, are my coworkers going to accept me? Is this going to stop me from being able to move up the ladder? Kind of things like that. excuse me. And so even with like all the jobs that I've had, I always like kind of tread the water slowly. And, you know, and like I said, because of my disability, I'm able to sometimes hide my sexuality. I don't always like lead with that role, even though that's something that I'm trying to practice more. And so With my jobs kind of moving forward, at the beginning, I was very closeted, very cautious, didn't want people to really know that side of me. I was very cautious about accepting even coworkers on like Facebook or social media or anything like that. But, you know, as I kind of got to know people, as I got to see that they were, you know, open-minded, things like that, or even if the organization that I was working for at the time, if they were open-minded, that kind of also opened up the door for me to be a little bit more out at work, things like that. One of the big organizations that did also help me with kind of being out at work too was with the Muscular Dystrophy Association, with working with a nonprofit. I guess it's also just been maybe the fields that I pick, you know. I've always worked with a lot of women, and so I've always felt pretty safe, thankfully, that like the women that I do work with have been really open-minded. And so I was able to kind of be out freely with them, you know, and then I was even able to be featured in a couple articles from MDA about my sexuality on like Quest magazine and things like that, about how it was for me to come out and talk about like pride and things like that. And then now that I work for a university, thankfully, you know, the university has like an LGBT, you know, resource center as well, right? They have the gender and sexuality resource center, right? Resource and cultural center. And also there's also an affinity group. So that's what I also recommend for people, that if you're trying to find a job and, you know, being out is a big aspect of who you are, right? Which, you know, it should be, and it is an important aspect. If you're not sure if your company will be a good positive work environment, to also look to see if there is an affinity group, or maybe also to consider the fact that, like, if you want that place to be more inclusive, that you might have to be one of the first people to maybe start an affinity group within your organization, so that you are able to kind of maybe help and bring and rally more people from the, you know, LGBTQ plus community, to also feel more openly accepted, you know, at your place of work. So that's been very nice. I also, with my students, I do work for the Disability Resource Center. So a lot of the students that I work with have, you know, varying types of disabilities, whether it be visible or invisible disabilities, you know, but I do try to put, you know, signs up that, you know, queer people are welcome, gay, lesbians, trans people, right? So that they know that when they come into my office, they see, you know, these different types of like signs up, and that they know that, you know, my office is a safe space for students, you know, with or without disabilities, to feel comfortable that I will not judge them, you know, based on what they tell me. And, you know, right now we are seeing a lot of like transphobia. So especially with people with disabilities, it is really hard as well for them. And so it's been nice for me to have like, you know, these kind of posters saying that I'm an ally, that I'm also a part of the community, right? So that people can come out to me and tell me, you know, if they're facing housing insecurity or if they're facing food insecurity, right? And, you know, and so these are all different resources that I'm able to offer. And unfortunately, right, when you're kind of looking for jobs or things like that, it is also harder for people with disabilities to find these types of employment. Plus, then you're even more of a marginalized group by also being part of the LGBT community. So it's like all these things compounding, which, you know, really makes you feel, you know, siloed, or that, you know, or accepted, right? And even too, right, within having a disability and then being part of the LGBT community, they're not like, people from the LGBT community can also be discriminatory, and they can also be bigoted, right? So when you have a disability, sometimes even trying to wander through those communities, you're like, man, like, you know, I'm trying to find acceptance, but like, it's even hard within these other communities, even though technically they should be more open-minded, because they're also being marginalized. That's not always the case. So yeah, I mean, it's a lot of things. And I absolutely love that segment that you read right now, because yeah, it definitely is that weird paradox that, you know, that is blaring as well.
Absolutely. Okay, so Allie, you're our resident mental health professional on this episode. I've been encouraged that I've been able to get one mental health professional on each one of the episodes in the series. And so I know this is something you talked about a lot when we did the one-on-one interview, but can you talk about how that aspect like coincides with the things you talked about earlier in this conversation? So about exploring your identity, about reaching people who struggle to find the right therapist because of belonging to multiple marginalized communities.
Yeah, I am a licensed social worker, and I work primarily in the telehealth industry. And so right now I'm working for an intensive outpatient program for youth and young adults. And so my role in that is to be a primary therapist for people that can meet with me on a weekly basis during the program, and also to run groups. And my job has been very accommodating as far as placing me with individuals and groups that I align with. So I have been put in several different LGBTQIA, oh my God, plus groups. And so it's been an amazing experience to talk to these individuals who are trying their very best to discover who they are with a mental health crisis. And that often correlates with having disabilities too, whether they are physical or strictly mental or any of them, you know? And I've been able to kind of like guide individuals with that process of self-acceptance or strictly doing things out of spite as well. And I love it. I noticed a very big disconnect from having a physical disability and being in the mental health care field. I know that a lot of therapists try to hide this aspect or try to not talk about their own journeys. And I'm not saying everyone, I'm saying a lot, but I find that it's really beneficial to be that voice and that authenticity for your clients whenever they're also struggling. You know, the past few weeks I've had clients tell me, I don't think I would be comfortable in this program unless you, if you were able-bodied and just typical, just a therapist, I wouldn't be comfortable talking to you. And it's made a really big impact because, you know, sometimes I have a lot of imposter syndrome and I don't feel like I'm doing what I should. And so hearing these things that people are craving authenticity and transparency in their own journeys, it's really made it really like I'm on the right field and track. I'm on the right track.
That's awesome. And no, I think that's totally understandable by why a lot of disabled clients wouldn't feel comfortable opening up entirely to someone who's not disabled. I mean, you need someone who can empathize with your experience that way. And I think the same goes for a lot of LGBTQ clients too. It's why the emphasis on intersectionality is so important. And then on that note too, I asked this question to Sherry, and I said, you've also written about how intersectionality is often overlooked in society and in disability communities. And I wanna highlight this quote from one of your columns. She said, "My nationality, ethnicity, gender identity, and sexuality may be rare within rare disease communities, but surely there must be others like me or others who aren't, but feel just as lonely and like they were cast aside." And I asked, what are some ways that society can provide better mental health resources for marginalized communities and be more inclusive? And Sherry's response was, as I explained in the column you referred to, we'd first have to recognize that every single person has intersecting identities. No one is disabled or queer, but many are disabled and queer. Might be because I'm best friends with our fellow columnist, Brianna Albers, shout out, who has a BA in psychology and is a mental health nerd, but I believe we need to approach mental health holistically. Counseling and educational resources that target the multiply marginalized and are affordable and easily accessible worldwide would be a start, but we need to see acceptance of disability and queerness, housing, education, employment, and other systemic issues as mental health issues too. And so that, yeah, was a really powerful quote. I mean, just a plug, if you have not read Sherry's columns, I highly recommend you do. She's a wonderful writer and I want to thank her for her contributions to this conversation. And so on that note, I want to talk with you both about ways that the disability community can, I think, be more inclusive, both LGBTQ people and have more mental health resources. And, you know, I'm speaking as a heterosexual white male and, you know, I mean, obviously been disabled my whole life, but I've still had to confront my own privilege and ignorance at times. And I want to thank, you know, people like you for coming on and advocating and being voices that we all need to hear. So I guess, Hugo, we'll start with you. So, I mean, because you and I have been a part of the SMA community for a long time, and that's how we met, was through conferences. And so what are some ways you think, let's start, the SMA community in particular can be more inclusive toward people of multiply marginalized communities and provide better mental health resources too?
Yeah, I think it's just with one of the things that Ellie mentioned earlier today too, and, you know, and Sherry too, about like how we're not just disabled, we're so much more than that, right? I mean, it is a huge part of our identity. It's why we're here today talking about this subject, but we don't live in a vacuum, right? We're not just disabled people, and we're all these other identities too. And so I love what, you know, Allie said about, like, you know, how her clients come up to her and they tell her that, like, oh my God, you're so needed in this field. Because that's something that I've struggled with throughout my time, like as an adult, just even seeking mental health and navigating that system, or like what your insurance covers, is so hard and complicated sometimes, right? Making sure that the provider that you're going to is within, like, I forget what that's called, but like covered, right, within like your insurance policy. And that's a headache in itself. And then I remember when I call and, like, you know, I finally reach the provider, and it's funny because I'm like, okay, can I please talk to someone that's from the LGBT community, preferably, you know, someone of color, right, or whatever, if possible. Also someone that knows about, like, disability, you know, and like mental health. Maybe someone that also knows about body image and, like, you know, things like that too, because these are all things that we struggle with. And so I know on the phone, they're always like, okay, we'll try to find someone that kind of fits all these different criteria that you're asking for. But hopefully this podcast will inform either current or future, you know, mental health professionals, or, you know, open up more of that gate that it is okay, or hopefully make it more socially acceptable for people to be able to, you know, kind of say it loud and proud that they are from these different communities, and that there are clients out there that are looking for them, but maybe can't find them because, you know, unfortunately society makes it taboo to talk about, like, what are your identities, right? But people want to talk to other people who they want to see themselves, right? Representation matters. And so, Ellie, I love you that you're, like, you know, a mental health professional and you're out there, because I've had a really hard time finding a mental health professional that also has a disability. And I've also had a hard time finding a mental health professional that's, like, you know, a Latina or a Latino, or that's even LGBT. So sometimes I just settle for someone that, you know, it's just a woman. Sometimes I feel more comfortable talking to women than I do to men, right? Because I don't know if they're cis, are they going to be judging me or things like that, right? Or I tend to be like, okay, well, if you know about disability, then yeah, I'll talk to you, because that's, you know, a big part of one of the things that I'm struggling with. But also recently, like, I had my father pass away. So I was like, okay, not only do I want to talk about all these other issues, but now I also want to talk about grief. So can you also add that on there to the list of things that, like, mentally I'm trying to, like, either combine or compartmentalize, or whatever you want to say. I can't think of the word right now. But yeah, so, like, these different things that I'm trying to, like, deal with, or coping mechanisms that I'm trying to have, so that, you know, I can walk into the room with all these different identities. But yeah, but it's definitely important, you know, for mental health providers to be able to be from these different, you know, minority groups, because I think it is needed. And it's something that, you know, hopefully by even having this conversation today, I have seen a big tick in, like, since the pandemic started, with, like, demystifying, and also, like, the fact that talking about mental health and seeking mental health is taboo, which I know that's also really big. And so I hope that this wave continues, not only with the isolation that everyone's felt, like, these past 2 to 3 years with the pandemic, but that it continues to be, because it's something that's super important, And just keep these conversations going. So big recommendation is have these conversations as many times as you can. Scream it from the rooftops. Try starting, you know, different groups within your work, within your communities, because there are other people like you out there, and they're also begging to be seen, and they're begging to kind of have these communities. So that's my biggest advice, to not be afraid to start these groups.
That's great. That's great. And Allie, same question to you about in terms of how the SMA and disability communities can be more inclusive and what mental health professionals can do in that regard. And also feel free to share any experiences you have with accessibility in the mental health field, anything like that you want to share.
Well, first of all, thank you, Hugo, for sharing that it has been a struggle for you being so involved in the disability community to seek mental health care for a provider who's in network and who is affordable, and because mental health care is sometimes not an affordable thing. And it's very tricky being the mental health care provider and still finding ways to provide for myself and then take care of a community that really needs this help too, you know. And it's with the pandemic, a lot of things are changing as far as telehealth platforms being available and accepting the right insurance and kind of just navigating that entire system, but it's still a new thing. And so a lot of times it is hard to find that unicorn of a therapist who is able to specialize and check all the boxes, you know? And I think it's a big need for people with disabilities and the queer community to come together and realize that if this is something that you have a passion for, that maybe this is something you could go to school for too. You know, like people who are in this community, like an education is sometimes really hard to come by, but it's really needed for the disabled and queer community to enter the field of mental health too, because we know, and we really struggle with this. So like, I'm always available to talk to anyone through this. It's a struggle. And Hugo, you're in the education field. And so you're, I'm sure, always like talking to people about this. And that's exciting because we need that. So as far as how to, you know, I've had a lot of people locally tell me that I couldn't be a therapist because I would be a liability. And like it's been said several times. And so the world of telehealth has really opened up my opportunity to thrive. And I would just say, like, if you're listening and if you are an active employer or in this field, then to give people with disabilities a chance, because we often can de-escalate better than you would imagine without using any type of physical force, because we can't. So we use our words and we use our emotions and feelings, and we're all, you know, it's easy to talk to people. So I would just say to keep that open mind, talk to individuals who are disabled and who are queer and who are able, safe enough to express that to you.
Yeah, Hugo, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. One more thing that I want to add is, Allie, I love the fact that you're like brought about like the fact about telehealth, right? Because I think it's super important that like we continue this momentum and don't like don't go back in time, right? Or like lose, like, you know, take one, two steps forward, three steps back, or whatever, five steps back. Because how Allie said, when you find your unicorn of a therapist that does fit all this criteria, right? Nothing can be more detrimental than, I remember before the pandemic, to them being like, okay, we found this person, they're the unicorn that you're looking for, but they're all the way in the north side of Chicago, and I live on the south side, right? And of course, the times that they can also meet with me are from 9 to 5, right? Which I understand, I respect it, right? Like they also want to work, you know, regular time hours. But in my mind, I'm like, okay, if I'm going to be traveling all the way to the north side, that's going to be an hour to get there, then a 1 hour session, and then a 1 hour back to get back. Like, it's not feasible in my time for me to be able to schedule this 3 hour block for me to meet with this unicorn of a therapist, you know? And so it's just not doable. Plus, when you have a disability, transportation is not always the best, even when you live in a big city like Chicago, which I feel like Chicago does have amazing transportation, but like, you know, these are all factors. And so I've loved the fact that, you know, with the pandemic, I think I've seen, like, I saw one therapist when things were in person right before the pandemic, and now I've seen two different therapists, you know, within the past 2 years, since the pandemic started, for different issues that I was facing, right? And I was able to do this so seamlessly and faster than before, because I was able to hop on a Zoom call, right? While I'm working from home in my own room, right? And just talk to them, you know, in between a meeting, or maybe I take my lunch during the time that I want to speak to my therapist. And it just makes it so much more accessible. And so people also need to not ignore the fact that a lot of people with disabilities, or maybe even the providers with disabilities, would greatly benefit from being able to provide Zoom sessions, you know? And so that is also something that needs to be amplified, the ability for things to also happen remotely and not just person to person. Yeah, and a Zoom call like this, if you still want to see a person, I love that this technology exists. So take full advantage of FaceTime technology.
It really is amazing how it's opened doors for so many people in our communities the last few years. And I hope that will continue. So that's huge. Well, and wrapping up here, so I know you've kind of answered this already, but I want to focus on just advice you have for people out there who may be struggling or wondering how to address their mental health. And I'm thinking particularly LGBTQ people in rare disease and disability communities. So Allie, we'll start with you. Like, what do you say to someone who is hesitant to look for a therapist or doesn't know where to start?
I would definitely check out psychologytoday.com to search for your entire state. Don't just limit it to the area that you're in. And kind of just scroll through. They have different checkboxes that you can click on. And if you do see a therapist and you're not comfortable with them, then you don't have to go back. It's not your obligation to make the therapist comfortable. And I'm often very blunt and transparent about that too. Cause I'm like, if at any point I say something that you don't like, then tell me. And if you don't feel comfortable telling me, you can write me, you can text me, you know? And I want people to feel comfortable with the therapist that they're with. And so that's my advice. It's like, just kind of do your research on, most people have a Psychology Today profile. And if, you know, it, but I'm not gonna negate, I'm not, I mean, like it is hard to find people. So just keep trying. Keep trying. That's all I can advise.
No, I love that. That's great. And Hugo, what would you say too to like LGBTQ people and disabled people in our communities who again want to address their mental health and they may not know where to start? What would you say to those individuals?
Yeah, what I want to say to people is don't feel the need to rush to have to come out also. I love how like I kind of stated, like, I mean, I had a very positive story. I love that Allie talked about, you know, she comes from like a more rural area, a smaller town, right? We both come from like conservative families, but in general, right, we'll wait out the waters, right? See what's right for you. Don't feel that you need to come out immediately. I talked about with like, you know, me trying to figure out, like, is it smart for me to come out to my family first? Is it smart for me to come out to my PCAs first, right? Because obviously we can't care for ourselves. So that should be your safety, should be the utmost, most important thing, right? That's the thing that you should keep at the forefront. Like, is it safe for you to be an out individual, right? And if it is, then definitely come out. But if it's not, don't feel that pressure, right? And if you are seeing someone, they should respect that decision too. And your friends should respect that as well, right? So that's super important. Also, when you're seeking mental health, to slowly keep, removing some of the stigmas, right? Involving mental health, right? And also realize that, you know, when you talk to your first therapist, whether you love them or whether you don't, and whether your insurance only covers a 3-month session, also realize that during that 3-month session, all your problems are not going to be magically fixed, right? But your goal should be, you know, can you get coping mechanisms from this therapist so that you're, you know, even after you finish your sessions that your insurance covers, you know, can you continue to kind of work on yourself? You know, for you to also keep a journal, what are the pressing matters? And your journal can be like crazy long, but try to prioritize what are the things that, you know, that of why you're seeking a mental health professional, right? Is it coming out? Is that your most important thing? Or is it family issues? Is it even just communication issues? Like, you know, if your family just can't even communicate, is it even possible then to bring this up, right? If the communication's not even there to begin with, even if you want to talk about, I don't know, like getting food, right? Like at a fast food restaurant, if no one can agree on that, right? That it's like, okay, then that's like another issue, communication within family. And like, you know, there are some families that like don't talk, but like, you know, they show affectionate by like getting you a gift or bringing you food, right? And that's how they show that like they care, right? And so there are so many different ways that you need to also realize like what are communication styles with different members of your family, you know, or maybe you just need to process your thoughts and dissect them, right? And maybe a therapist can help you with that too, right? If you're like, man, all of these things are my number one, then maybe you talking to a therapist, that could be what they help you is like figuring out, you know, how to deal with different things. And from seeing different therapists, I will also say, this might sound funny, but I kind of like it when I had my first therapist ever did not give me what I would call like homework. But then my last two therapists that I did see, they would actually email me articles or like different little booklets or things that I can fill out and write in, because I'm not someone that just naturally journals, right? And I love that Sherry kind of talked about that, like when she would journal, mm-hmm. it would kind of, you know, help her process the emotions that she was going through. But I needed guided journals. I did need that homework. So when I did find therapists that would give me homework, I loved it because I'm like, okay, you're telling me that I am dealing with like, I don't know, with just like grief, right? Send me articles on grief. How can I like better process these emotions? How can I stop, creating these catastrophic events in my head too, right? Or, you know, or if I'm disassociating from like what's happening in reality, how can I enjoy different things in life? And so I really loved kind of doing these guided journals and writing things out. And like, you know, if you don't know where to begin with, don't be afraid to also ask your therapist, hey, would you mind sending me articles? Do you recommend books that I can read? Are there a guided journal meditation that you would recommend I buy on Amazon, right? If it's hard for you to go out there and you needed to have it shipped to your house. I love how Allie recommended a website. Are there websites that I can go to, you know, that are also maybe free or low cost that I can also kind of go to? So I'm saying a lot, but in general, just know that there's not one quick fix, and therapy should definitely, maybe it's a long-term thing for you where you'll constantly be seeing someone. So don't get frustrated, you know, if you need a quick fix or if you need a long-term fix. It's something that mental health is not, it's something that you should continuously be working with, right? Just like how we want to be better people. Life continues to happen. And so, you know, back in the day, I was, you know, dealing with my sexuality. So maybe, you know, I talked to a therapist about that. I remember when my parents got separated, I talked to a therapist about that. You know, when my father died, that was another thing about grief. So as you can see, there are many different reasons to talk to a therapist, depending on what's happening in your life as well. And just the way you would get a checkup, sorry, last thing, we see our primary care doctors and we see our neurologists, right? Because our disability is progressing. Mental health should be something too, that like we constantly see someone for help, also getting in tune with what's happening.
Oh, that's huge. I think that's a great analogy there. Absolutely. And then to wrap up, I asked Sherry this question and her response was, I think everyone's situation is so different when we're queer and disabled that the only advice I can offer is to take things one day at a time. Societies change and so do people and circumstances. I used to be a dramatic teen who thought I'd die without anyone knowing I'm queer, particularly in Singapore, where homosexuality is still criminalized in 2022. But now I've written about it publicly, and I have a long-distance relationship with a partner I love dearly. Things don't always seem like they'll get better, but they can. So I think that's a great quote to end on there. But I want to thank you all for so much for coming to this. This has been a really great conversation, and I think it will impact a lot of people. So Hugo, Ali, thank you so much. Sherry, thank you so much. This has been great. And before we go, Hugo, Ali, do either of you want to plug anything, either social media pages, websites, anywhere people can find you?
Yeah. I mean, Hugo Trevino here. I mean, I have Facebook, I have Instagram. Y'all can find me on there. I also have LinkedIn. Feel free to also add me on like those kind of social pages. I don't have a personal website, so just kind of social media is my thing right now. But yeah, I'm happy to connect with anyone that's dealing with similar issues. And, you know, even though I'm not a mental health professional, you know, I tried doing a lot of personal growth, and I'm here to kind of redirect you or send you resources, right? So that you're at least don't feel so lost.
That's great.
Yeah. And I do have a Facebook called, it's facebook.com/ Ali Ramos Therapy. And that's ALIRAMOS Therapy. And you can find me on there, or you can look at my my personal pages too. I'm on Instagram and Facebook, and that's pretty much it. Okay. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And we'll link those in the description, and I'll also link Sherry's column. But Hugo, Ali, Sherry, thank you so much again. This has been great. And for our listeners out there, you can hear more conversations and stories like this by subscribing to the SMA News Today podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. You can also connect with us directly on our forums and find all of our content, articles, podcasts on smanewstoday.com for the latest SMA news and perspectives. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Thanks so much, and we will see you next time. Take care.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.smanewstoday.com. And be sure to follow us on social media and join our SMA News Today forums, a trusted SMA community ready to welcome you anytime.